A resume of epic proportions. My 50 jobs in 50 years, read by me, the author, Jim Tidyman. My life has no purpose. My life has no direction, no aim, no meaning, and yet I'm happy. I can't figure it out. What am I doing right? By Charles Schulz. From the time I was 10 years old, and for the last 50 years, deciding what I wanted to do for a living always escaped me. Instead of long-term stable employment and a secure retirement, the focus was to survive, get by, and pay the bills. I've had jobs that lasted as little as 15 minutes and as long as 5 years. I've been fired from several, but quit most of them. I've had jobs I hated, jobs I loved or liked or tolerated. The same goes for the people I've worked for. I've never paid into a pension that I know of. Although 401ks had a nice ring to them, I never took advantage of one. With no retirement plan or retirement savings, I thought that working until I dropped was my destiny. Sometimes I gave my best, and sometimes much less. So much of it was dependent on the job I had, what it required, and even more so for whom I was working. I believe that most of the people I've worked for were glad they hired me and were sorry to see me leave. I did well with reviews, raises, and positions of increasing authority. What did I do with these attributes? Not much. I was content just getting by. I managed all this with the help of some innate talents, good sense of humor, luck, drive, great friends, and being in the right place at the right time. Would I advise people to follow my path? Maybe not the actual path, but the attitude. I was willing to do anything for anyone and never shied away from reinventing myself. This whole ride won't make much sense to everyone. But when I look back, it all seemed like a good idea at the time. Chapter 1, Lakewood, Ohio, 1960 to 1969. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1950, the fourth child of Robert Murray. Three more brothers, one of whom lived only a couple of days, were born after me. In all, I had five brothers and one sister. Robert, now deceased, Paul, Kathy, John, then me, David, and Richard. Many baby boomer families, especially if they were Catholic, were large. Our mother raised us to be Catholic. Dad didn't care, since it gave him a few hours of peace and quiet while we all went to Sunday Mass, and he read the newspaper, drank a cup of coffee, smoked a few cigarettes, without any disturbances. By the time I was four, my mom, dad, and six siblings had moved to Lakewood, Ohio, a predominantly white, middle-class suburb on the west side of Cleveland. My dad worked for the Cleveland Plain Dealer as the chief police reporter. He didn't make that much money, especially to support such a large family. My mom didn't work outside the house until after my father died in 1971 at the age of 47. I asked my mom once why she and Dad had decided to have so many children. I said, "Wouldn't it have made more sense economically to have just two kids, say me and Kathy, her two easiest children?" When I told my sister this story, she was elated that of all my siblings, I picked her for this hypothetical family. Actually, I was simply looking for gender balance. Although, if I only had one other sibling, Kathy would be a great one. My mom said that she and Dad always wanted a big family. She said, when your father would come home from work in the winter, around 1 or 2 in the morning, he worked swing shift, and that big warm body of his would sidle up to me in the bed, and one thing led to another, and the next thing I knew, I was pregnant. I said, but wouldn't he get us a little concerned after the fourth or fifth pregnancy was announced? No, said Mom. He'd just look at me and say, that's great, Marie. My point? Since there was no extra money floating around, we all headed out the door to make our own just as soon as we could. None of us received an allowance, even though all of us had friends who regularly received one. One day, when I was 10 or 11, I built up enough courage to ask my dad for an allowance. I don't know what the hell I was thinking. I said, Dad, can I have an allowance? Playing dumb, he asked me, what's an allowance? I replied, that's where once a week you give me a set amount of money. Said he, why do I give you this money? I was getting a little antsy by now, but I said, "You just do. It's called an allowance." "Okay," said Dad. "So what you're saying is that for no reason at all, I give you this allowance every week, right?" "Yeah," said I. Dad said, "how much should I give you?" Figuring I'd start small, I said, "A quarter." He reached into his pocket, pulled out a quarter, and handed it to me. I thanked him and walked away. I never got any more money after that. I never mentioned it again, and neither did he. In the end, I thought it was a pretty silly way to obtain money. Nearly all my brothers either had or helped one another with paper routes. No one ever asked me if I wanted a paper route, nor did I ever ask to have one. I don't recall how much money my brothers earned, but whatever it was, it seemed that getting up at 4:30 every morning to deliver newspapers, in the dark, rain or snow, for an hour simply wasn't worth it. I think all of us cut lawns, rake leaves, and shovel snow at one time or another. My sister latched on to the old standby for preteen and teenage girls babysitting. When I was finally old enough to push a mower, drag a rake, or shove a shovel, I was earning money in the neighborhood with regular seasonal customers, cutting lawns, raking leaves, and shoveling snow. Although these money-making activities didn't vary much, every now and then one of my regular customers would ask me to do something a little out of the ordinary. Take Miss Jarvis, for instance. She didn't have an accent, but to look at her, you would think a thick European one would color every phrase she uttered. When I first started working for her, she was in her late 70s. 4 feet 11 inches tall, rounded and a little slumped like a snowman starting to melt. She had pure white hair that contrasted with a set of black eyebrows that lay above her eyes like a couple of large, live, dark, woolly caterpillars. It was impossible not to stare. She was quick to smile, very appreciative of any work I do, and very generous. Depending on the season, I worked all year long. One spring day, after I'd cut her lawn and was collecting my $2.50 wage for the day, Miss Jarvis asked, "Jim, would you be interested in taking on another small job?" "Yes," I said. "What is it?" "I want you to come by every morning and clean out the bird bath in the backyard and fill it with fresh water. It's got to be done every morning until the first freeze. I'll give you 50 cents every time you do it." "Great, an extra $3.50 a week for a 6 month bird bath season." "Sure," I said, "I'll start tomorrow morning." This was a job in keeping with Miss Jarvis's gentle nature. I didn't know it then, but it was a portent of things to come. 20 years later, I was cleaning out septic tanks. More on that shitty job later. School was nearly out for the summer, and Miss Jarvis lived right down the street. It was an easy gig. I didn't think about it then, but now I can imagine Miss Jarvis watching out her rear window, enjoying the sight of birds splashing around in the fresh water. That was back in 1960. I was 10 and cut lawns the old-fashioned way with a manual push mower. Push mowers are still manufactured today, but I can't imagine why anybody would buy one. As I recall, our family mower was misnamed something like Glide-O-Matic or the Lawn Dream. It was as classic or antique as any push mower could have been. As rent for the use of this gem, I had to cut our lawn before those of any of my customers. This was fine with me. I was, and always have been, a very good-natured person. As almost all middle children in a fairly dysfunctional family, I was the people pleaser. Whether it was cutting our lawn, raking our leaves, or shoveling our snow, I was usually ready, willing, and able to do the job. 47 years later, I can still see the texture and unevenness of the cement or sandstone slabs that made up our driveway and walk, the rise on the right side of our front lawn and the flatness of the left, the half lawn and half garden in the backyard, and the gravel apron leading up to our garage. By the time I was 12 or 13, I realized that if someone lent me the money, $60 in 1960, I could buy a power rotary mower and cut enough lawns to pay back the loan in the first month of summer. Even though my parents rarely had extra money floating around after they paid the bills, my dad surprised me by coming up with it. We sealed the deal. Perhaps he regretted having made me feel humiliated when I asked him for an allowance. The only stipulation was that I had to keep cutting the family lawn. No problem. Why I didn't apply the same logic to buying a snowblower, I'll never know. Although the time and effort expended pushing a power rotary mower was a lot less than pushing the Glide-O-Matic, I did not start mowing more lawns and making more money. Perhaps one's work habits and ability to plan financially for the future are instilled long before one sets out to earn one's first buck, or even before one exits the womb. Whatever the case, even today I'm satisfied with just getting by and staying current with the bills, just as my parents did. If I had 6 customers with the manual mower at the beginning of the summer, I still had 6 with the power mower by the time fall rolled around. The only difference was that the work was much easier. None of my customers stood out except one. No, not quite worthy of a Reader's Digest most unforgettable character column, just interesting. Directly behind our house, one street west of ours, was Waterbury Avenue, and this was where one of my first and longest-standing customers, Mr. and Mrs. Hope, lived. They were in their 70s when I first started cutting their lawn. Mrs. Hope was a school teacher. She was the one I dealt with. Like Miss Jarvis, minus the eyebrows, she was a very pleasant, easygoing woman, generous with cash paid for services rendered, and always appreciative. I thought her husband, Mr. Hope, was a lawyer. He certainly dressed very well and carried a briefcase, if that's an indication. He was a rather short man with a medium build. He wore his short gray hair in a flat top. He also had a huge growth on his neck, 2 inches below his right ear. It was the size of a racquetball. I didn't ask what it was, and they didn't tell me. Since this growth was so close to his face, I could stare at it with impunity. Actually, it was so bizarre-looking, I tried not to stare at it. Mr. Hope would stop on his way into the house just long enough to smile and say hello. The only strange things about the Hope, other than Mr. Hope's neck growth, was the bushel basket of empty wine bottles I noticed every time I cut the lawn, which was every 7 to 10 days, depending on the rainfall. I wasn't being judgmental about it. I assumed Mr. Hope had consumed the wine because I assume lawyers drank a lot, don't they? Or is it that after we deal with a lawyer, we want to drink a lot? Because I was only 13 years old, I was surprised at the amount. Now I understand. A bushel of empty wine bottles once a week? Big deal. I can do that. I have done that. I continued mowing the Hope's lawn, shoveling their sidewalks, and marveling at their wine consumption until I graduated from high school and joined the U.S. Air Force. To this day, I love the smell and sight of freshly cut lawns and leaf-free front yards just after they've been raked, and smooth sidewalks and driveways after the snow has been cleared. So I started raking in the dough at age 10. What did I do with most of it? By this time, I was becoming aware of how I looked and what kind of impression I made on people, primarily girls. My cash income was rising in direct proportion to my distaste of my mother's selection of clothes for me. This worked out perfectly. She was more than ready to stop buying for me, and I was more than ready to start on the path to sartorial splendor. I also started putting away a little money. For example, each year I started a Christmas club fund. This was a great marketing ploy for the Broadview Savings and Loan Bank. The idea was that you picked out an amount of money you wanted to save by the time Christmas shopping season started. My first Christmas club goal was $120. The bank then issued a coupon payment book with 12 coupons for $10 each. Every month, or whenever you could afford to do it, you paid off a coupon. By the time you were done, you hoped by November, you had a tidy shopping stash of $120 plus interest. Being able to buy my own clothes, start a savings account, and have a little cash in my pocket fostered my sense of independence. I rarely had to ask my parents for spending money. Good thing, since I'd already tried the allowance route. One of my favorite treats after a long day of hard work was to load up with a bag full of penny pretzels or Lance peanut butter cheese crackers and a couple of cold 16-ounce bottles of Coca-Cola. After a hot bath or shower, I'd plop my ass down in front of the television and eat and drink all that crap until I was full. To this day, I remain a man of simple pleasures. My first job as a tax-paying American was as a soda jerk at Benfield's Drugstore at the intersection of Lewis Drive and Detroit Avenue, a 5-minute walk from home. All I had to do to get there was walk out the front door, skip down the steps of our big front porch, and hike down the street. Benfield's was torn down long ago. It sat right next to St. Edward's All-Boys High School. Even as a young teenager, I appreciated the beauty of Benfield's. Like many of the houses and buildings in Lakewood, Ohio, It was probably built around the turn of the century by German and Eastern European immigrant craftsmen. It had a high pressed tin ceiling, wicker blades on the ceiling fans, and marble floors. People enjoyed their ice cream and soda treats at a marble-topped soda fountain where they sat on high-backed wicker stools with brass footrests. The water and soda spigots were made of marble and chrome. The glass cases were 5 feet tall, and I could barely see over them. They kept the valuables in the glass cases, the candy bars, pens, lighters, and anything small enough to slide into one's pocket. One day I saw a help wanted sign in the window. I applied, and before I knew it, I started my work as a soda jerk, dispensing goods from behind the counter and earning a whopping dollar an hour. Of course, I supplemented my income with every candy bar, hot dog, or hamburger I could stuff down my gullet without being seen by Dr. Broadhurst or Dr. Cochran, the two pharmacist owners. Both these guys were in their 80s when I started working there. Dr. Cochran, white-haired, balding, and stoop-shouldered, was an easygoing old coot. He was the one who hired me. His wife worked there occasionally. She reminded me of a very tall prune. She gave me a teaspoon of paregoric once after I had complained about a stomach ache. Think it had anything to do with the two burgers, the three Reese's peanut butter cups I had just washed down with a cherry Coke? Dr. Broadhurst, about 4'11", at this point in his life, was one funny-looking guy. He reminded me of what the comic actor Don Knotts looked like at the end of his life. He was pleasant enough, but I had the impression he only tolerated me. I'm not surprised. At 5'4", I towered over him. Getting away with the occasional snack at Benfield's did not take cat burglar skills. In fact, the store had a reputation for being easy. Doctors Broadhurst and Cochran were both hard of hearing and could generally be counted on to fall asleep 30 seconds after their tired butts hit the office chairs in the back room. For some reason, I figured it was okay for me to get fat while they weren't looking, but no one else was going to steal anything on my watch. I was not a big guy back then. Maybe I tipped the scale at 130 pounds. Most of my customers were from the junior high down the street and from St. Ed's right next door. Something about my being behind the counter added enough stature to keep most of the kids honest. Okay, not that honest. For more than a few months, I stole condoms from the back room and sold them to some of the senior high school football players. My contribution to help curb teen pregnancy. Despite their age, or because of it, the two doctors knew a little about marketing. Once a week, just around the time the junior high kids were filtering in, Dr. Cochran would make me fill the Kotex rack. I knew what they were for, and could not think of anything more embarrassing than to stock the rack in front of my classmates. I complained to Dr. Cochran about this once. He said, "Jim, when the girls are coming in after school, seeing you fill those shelves will remind them to stock up." I worked there while I was in 9th and 10th grades. The job ended when the good doctors decided it was time to retire. The next job, one of my many brief ones to come, was as a busboy and dishwasher at a restaurant, again on Detroit Avenue, called the Copper Kettle. It, too, is long gone. I don't think the job lasted more than a week. My reason for leaving? The heat and smell from washing the dishes, the stench from the accumulated food and trash, and the odors of old grease were too much for my tender teen stomach. Or was it the hard work? Chicken Galore, the next rung on my climb up the employment ladder, wasn't quite as bad, and for all I know, the place may still be there. It was a fried chicken and ribs carryout. I remember that the chicken was pretty good, but the ribs, especially by today's standards, were outstanding. I was hired as an all-around helper. My duties included, but were not restricted to, frying the French fries, putting the dinners together in styrofoam containers, washing the cooking utensils, pots, pans, etc., and my least favorite, pulling the last of the chicken guts out of the chickens. At the time, Chicken Galore was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Mace. They were an ill-tempered, scary-looking partnership. Think of a couple of the fresher-looking zombies from the movie Dawn of the Dead, and you'll have an idea of what these two look like. Mr. Mace was the scarier of the two. It didn't take much imagination to see him with a meat cleaver in one hand, stuffing babies into the fryer with the other. I hope by now both these folks are in chicken and rib heaven. I don't recall what I was earning at the time, probably something like $2.50 an hour. Naturally, it was an after-school and weekend job. My favorite benefit was the half-price discount on the chicken and ribs and free chicken at the end of the night, provided it was overcooked and no one else wanted it. I love well-done fried chicken. Loved it then, and I love it now. It certainly seemed like an awfully long time between those great ribs from Chicken Galore and restaurants in general, finally figuring out how to prepare them the way they do today. It's only in the last 5 or 6 years that one could go into a restaurant, order ribs, and be fairly confident that they were going to be the fall-off-the-bone ribs everyone's mouth hopes for. I worked at Chicken Galore quite a while. By my standards back then, that equaled at least a few months. That was an eternity compared to how long my brother John worked there. He was hired at 4 in the afternoon as a delivery driver, given his first assignment, and did not return until 9 that night with the same 4 orders of chicken, now cold, sitting on the front seat of his car. Apparently, he could not find the addresses and was fired. How embarrassing for me. One of my shortest-lived jobs, 45 minutes, came next. I was hired as a telemarketer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I'm sure I said to myself, not for the first time, and definitely not for the last, how tough could it be? I was handed a script, given a little training, assigned a phone and a cubicle, and told, "Have at it." If you've never tried your hand at telemarketing, you may think it sounds like an easy job. I certainly thought it would be. I don't think it held the same stigma back then as it does now. With a little effort, I might have been successful. After 5 or 6 rejections in a row, however, I completely reversed my attitude. I give up easily unless it's something really stupid and has no chance of bearing any fruit. Then I hang on like a snapping turtle with a stick in its mouth. Instead of setting down the phone and walking out, I called my girlfriend Diane, figuring we could chat for an hour or so while I was paid my draw. Apparently, my work ethics had not matured much by this point. 5 minutes into the conversation, the motivational supervisor, crew leader, captain of us all, tapped me on the shoulder and explained that all calls were being monitored. I told Diane and anyone else who was listening in that I would call her later that night when I got home, since I needed to get off the phone so they could fire me. I did start selling newspaper subscriptions again, but that's a story for later. First, I was going to conquer the world of shoe sales. Is it just as easy to get retail service-oriented jobs today as it was back then? I think so. I can't recall how detailed any of the interviews were. I must have walked in the door, breathed on the mirror they held under my nose, suitable test for confirming whether you're dead or alive, and started working. Given some of the retail clerks you run into every day, they must still be using that same qualifying test. My mom said, on many occasions, especially to me, her favorite, "Don't quit your present job until you have another one lined up." I didn't follow that advice much back then, but one didn't need to. I worked steadily from my first job at Ventfields all through high school and into the Air Force. I am also sure I quit whenever I felt like it and got a job the next day. I have been fortunate enough to either find something right away or spend every bit of the 6 months of unemployment benefits looking for something else. Selling shoes. This was the first of 2 shoe sales jobs I had. Thank God I had the first one, so I could use all that technical experience to land the second one. The first one had me measuring feet and fitting shoes in the Westgate Shopping Mall in Rocky River, Ohio. My claim to fame in this short-lived job was selling a pair of size 14 white high-top tennis shoes to Ron Penfound, who at the time was the host of an after-school kids program featuring reruns of The Little Rascals and The Three Stooges. His stage name was Captain Penny. He wore a train conductor's hat and what I guessed was a train conductor's shirt when he was on air. He might have had a goofy sidekick, like a talking moose. Or was that Captain Kangaroo? I do recall being embarrassed watching his program, whose banter was supposed to appeal to the 4 to 8-year-old crowd. I endured him because I liked The Little Rascals and The Three Stooges. I still do. One night, this gangly superstar of the preschool set walked into my shoe store. I have to say I handled this encounter with as much grace and dignity as I did when I ran into Jane Fonda 4 years later. Actually, I was a little more outgoing with Jane. Ron handed me a white high-top tennis shoe and said he needed to see them in a size 14. I found them. He tried them on. They fit. He paid for them, and he was out the door. While he was there, I did not say, "Hey, aren't you Captain Penny?" or, "Hey, Captain, can I have your autograph?" Whom would I impress with that? My six-year-old neighbor? In the end, I didn't say anything except maybe, "Thanks for the business, sir." Did I quit that job because I had a feeling that nothing in the shoe-selling world was going to top that experience? No. The mall was too far from home, was a pain in the ass to get to every day. Reason enough for me. After that episode, or maybe because of that, I was ready to dive back into the world of newspaper subscription sales. My brother John and I started working this job at the same time. This was a job my dad got for us while he was still the chief police reporter at the Plain Dealer. We were part of a sales crew that met every day after school in a drugstore near the corner of West 140th Street and Lorraine Avenue. The job was fairly straightforward. A crew, consisting of me, my brother, two other salesmen, and the crew chief, would pile into the crew chief's car. We'd go to a predetermined street, meet with the local paper route carrier, a.k.a. Paperboy, and then go door-to-door with him to all those houses that were not on his subscription list. We call them the unsubscribed. Our job was not to sell the benefits of having the news delivered to their doorstep, rain or shine, every day of the year. We were not selling the importance of being in tune with the local, state, national, and international scenes. We were not selling the power of information, and we were not selling the writing and reporting excellence of the Plain Dealer. What's left? If the customer would agree to subscribe to the Plain Dealer, little Timmy, the paper boy, could win one of many swell prizes and a chance for the grand prize at the end of the year. That was it. It was a make-or-break deal. Either they gave a shit about little Timmy or they didn't. A surprising number of people did. My brother John and I were clearing anywhere from $20 to $40 a week in commission, a great salary for someone in high school. The newspaper subscription job was not at all interesting, but the crew we worked with was. Once you headed south, away from Lake Erie, the style of dress and demeanor of kids, aged 14 to 20, changed dramatically. The closer you lived to Lake Erie on the west side, Lakewood, Rocky River, Westlake, Avon Lake, etc., the more likely you'd fall into the Beach Boys surfer style of dress, behavior, and look. This was identified by slightly long, freshly shampooed hair falling over the forehead. The surfers wore madras shirts, khakis, and penny loafers, without the penny. They wore English leather or canoe cologne. The farther south you traveled, past Triscuit and Lorraine Avenues, out toward Cleveland and Parma, the more likely you'd represent the greaser style, identified by slick back hair, ducktails, white or black shirts, black leather dress jackets, pointy black shoes, and rolled-up short-sleeved t-shirts holding a pack of Camels or Lucky Strikes. The greasers did sound more interesting. John and I fell into the surfer category while the rest of the crew were greasers. Typically, the greasers were scarier-looking of the two groups, especially since they had a well-earned anti-establishment reputation and really disliked surfer types. They thought we were pussies. This did not become a contentious relationship, however. John and I fit right in. It must have had something to do with our winning personalities. I'm serious. We do have winning personalities. I felt like they made us their token surfers. They wanted to introduce us to their world by taking us to places like the short oval dirt track to watch car races. We went with them one night and could not really appreciate the entertainment value. It was difficult to tell who was winning the races. It was loud as hell, and we were too young to drink. But then, I think the greasers would have felt equally out of place in cut-off jeans hanging out on Huntington Beach in Rocky River. One night, when the paper boy and I finished his route, we headed into his house. I sat on his front porch steps waiting for the crew manager to pick me up. It must have been in the fall, because by this time the sun had set. After a half an hour of waiting, I had to go pee. I was too embarrassed to knock on the paper boy's door to see if I could use his bathroom. Instead, I walked a couple of doors down where there was a dark alley between two apartment buildings. As soon as I was safely in the shadows, I took a whiz, zipped up, and got ready to head back to the paperboy's house. What I hadn't noticed was that 10 feet from where I was watering the grass was a basement apartment window. About the time I glanced at it, the tenants, at least two guys, noticed me and yelled, "Holy shit, there's someone out there looking in the window. Let's fucking get him." I flew out of there faster than the roadrunner being chased by Wile E. Coyote. I got back to the paperboy's house and dived into the bushes. Within 20 seconds, four guys were seriously looking for me. Had they found me, they would have kicked my ass all the way back to Lakewood. There is no way I would have been able to convince them that I was a peeing Tom, not a peeping Tom. I still remember the name of our crew. Terry, the chief, who reminded me of the Fonz from Happy Days. One of the crew members, Eddie, reminded me of a cross between Horseshack on Welcome Back, Kotter, and Kramer from Seinfeld. I was 17 at the time and must have kept this job for more than a few months because I remember sweating in the summer and freezing in the winter. I don't recall why I quit, but that's not unusual. It was just time to move on. Speaking of jobs my dad lined up for us, he must have thought this next one was pretty funny. Dad corralled John and me on a Saturday afternoon before we flew out the back door. He told us he had a job for us the following weekend at the Cleveland Convention Center. We would be ushers at the 37th annual Strut Your Mutt dog show. Dress was casual. John and I were to provide our own transportation by walking to the Rapid Transit Station on 117th Street and Madison Avenue, about a mile and a half, and getting off at the Terminal Tower, the central transportation hub in downtown Cleveland. From there, we were to walk to the convention center, enter door number something, and report to the main man. We would be paid $5 an hour for 2 8-hour shifts starting Saturday and ending Sunday. I'm sure John and I were so dumbstruck by the huge payday that it didn't dawn on us that maybe the big bucks had something to do with the nature of the job. It turned out that we were not necessarily ushers. In fact, we were pooper scoopers, or, as they referred to us for 16 hours, cleanup boys. Thank God we were identified by numbers, so we didn't have to hear our real names booming out of the PA system for the seemingly constant cleanup emergencies of prodigious piles of poop. I can still hear that loudspeaker today. Cleanup boy, aisle 23, booth 14, beagle. Okay, so the beagle pile wasn't too bad. Pretty small dog. But you knew you were in for it when you heard, aisle 19, German Shepherd. Aisle 49, Malamute. Aisle 78, St. Bernard. I don't know how large the crew was. It's not like we got together after work to shoot the shit. It was not large enough as far as I was concerned. I remember passing John a couple of times on our respective poop patrol pickup missions. We looked at each other with the same look on our faces and the same thought in our heads. Thanks, Dad. We owe you one. By now, I had reached the end of my high school career and had thought a lot about my immediate future. So had my dad. I didn't like high school. I didn't do very well. I dated a lot, but could not seem to relate to any of the cliques. I wanted to, but just did not have a clue. Even though I am one smart fellow, I think, I ranked at the bottom of my class. I had grades good enough to graduate, but that was about it. My self-esteem, I thought, was not high enough to deal with the rigors of teenage life in a large co-ed public school system. I maintained a very small circle of friends, but rarely attended any of the social and sporting events associated with high school. For instance, I may have gone to only one football game or one high school dance. I did not join anything. I never ate in the cafeteria. I walked the half mile home from school every day at noon for lunch. I skipped my prom and graduation ceremony. I remember walking into the school office one day after the formal graduation just to pick up my diploma. I wasn't a total slug, just a moody, self-absorbed goof. I was working, was able to do a fairly respectable job of dressing myself. I was considered one of the better-dressed students. Despite this morose-sounding existence, most of that demeanor showed itself on school grounds. Around the house, with my siblings, very few friends and parents, I was, and still am, a very easygoing, affable guy who enjoys being with them and my buddies. None of my behavior prevented me from pursuing that which I spent an inordinate amount of time on, women. I managed to date quite a few of my fellow female classmates. I was considered good-looking back then, and may have had that Jim Morrison mysterious moodiness about me. It wasn't all bad, just strange. Since my second worst embarrassing moment involved a job I had much later on, it's only right that I detail the first worst embarrassing moment, even though it had nothing to do with working. It happened while I was still in high school. I was a junior and dating this really cute sophomore, Diane. She was the younger sister of Lonnie, who was dating my brother John. Diane was petite, blonde, and cute as hell. It was a short romance, as were most of the high school flings. I remembered passing notes in school, long and incredibly important phone conversations, and one night necking on her sofa at her parents' house. I should not have been there, not because there was anything inherently wrong with the whole scene, but because I had a pretty bad cold. Love conquers all, right? I felt pretty shitty, stuffed nose and all, but we still managed to find necking fun. At some point, we broke our embrace, probably to breathe, and while I intently looked into her eyes, I accidentally breathed through my nose and blew out this huge snot bubble. Not bad enough, it didn't pop, and I instinctively sucked it back in. I knew it was a bubble because it was big enough for me to see by looking down my nose. I'd say, at its zenith, it was the size of a ping-pong ball. I was shocked in paralysis. Diane was shocked into hysterical fits of laughter, so violent she fell off the sofa. I don't recall how the rest of the evening went. My embarrassment lasted for the next couple of days. To Diane's credit, she never mentioned the incident. I was never referred to as Snot Bubble Boy. In high school, I took graphic arts, print shop, for 3 years, taught by Mr. Teffler. He was about as gruff as anyone would be who had to put out the school newspaper on a regular basis while he rode roughshod over the semi-interested high school kids. He looked a lot like Moe from the Three Stooges, only with a flat-top haircut. Because I had such an interest from the beginning, I learned quite a bit and was able by my junior year and senior year to work on projects I thought were fun. I especially liked designing and printing stationery for my friends and family, in particular my oldest brother Robert, whom I was always trying to impress. During the Vietnam War, Robert was stationed at West Point. He was not a cadet, he was a musician. He learned through a friend who was also a musician at West Point that the Army was looking for someone to play in the NCO and officer clubs on nights and weekends. Robert figured that he would be much better off if he volunteered to serve at West Point rather than wait to be drafted and get shipped to Vietnam. He auditioned, made the grade, and enlisted. In addition to playing piano in the clubs, Robert was assigned other duties. He managed the inventory of band uniforms and worked as a lifeguard at one of the many mountain lakes in New York State. In short, Robert's time in the Army was about as far away from war and combat as you could get. That's why he and I thought his request for me to make him some stationery was pretty funny. In the top left-hand corner, he wanted a line drawing of a knight in armor, sword drawn, sitting on top of a horse with old English lettering next to it saying, Warrior Prince. I produced a ream, 500 sheets, of just that, stationery that he used from the time he got into the Army until the time he got out. I enjoyed almost everything about the print shop, and I thought perhaps it could be a career. I knew that if I were apprenticed as a printer, I would be exempt from the draft. I didn't become an apprentice for that reason. I just thought I would like to give printing a shot. The father of a classmate was a partner in a print shop in Cleveland called Emerson Press. At the beginning of the summer of my junior year, I interviewed for the apprentice position. I was hired and put on 3 months probation before I would be considered an apprentice. Although I was fascinated with this fairly large professional printing company, the work they had me doing was very menial. I emptied trash cans and swept the floors. I sorted and collated small printing jobs. I folded brochures when the folding machines were down. I was bored and disillusioned, and it showed. One day, as I moped around with broom in hand, I noticed one of the printers at his workbench mixing black and green inks. I'm sure he noticed me out of the corner of his eye. As he was mixing, he set the mixing knife down and rubbed his hands over the thick puddle of ink, pulling them back quickly as if the ink was heating up. As I got closer and showed more interest, he repeated this action of mixing, rubbing his hands, pulling them out of the fire, so to speak. Finally, I stood right next to him. He gestured toward this thick puddle of black and green ink and said, "Check it out." I reached out with one hand, placed it a foot above the ink. I didn't feel any heat, so I lowered my hand 2 inches from the ink. Then he smashed my hand into the top of the puddle. He and the other five printers who were now gathered behind me thought this was the funniest goddamn thing they'd seen since the last time they'd done it. I realized a year later that my 3-month probationary period had much more to do with observing my attitude than it did with my expertise. In the end, I did not get the apprenticeship. I guess I was meant to go to war.